Oregon State Board of Nursing, and to my left is Pat Miles, who's the business manager for the Board of Nursing, and to her left is Erica Kleiner, who is the DAS budget analyst.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Chair, could I ask Ms. Bouchard to pull the microphone closer to her? Okay, anytime you're ready, you may proceed.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to do a little bit of follow-up from yesterday. People asked us some questions, and on your desk today are some of the answers to those questions. One of the questions, and I think it was you, Senator Burley, that asked, how do nurses know what is the standard of practice and conduct derogatory? And so on your, at your place, we have this pamphlet that we give to every nurse who we license. And I have marked where we have the standards of conduct that we describe to them. And also marked in this booklet is the conduct derogatory to the standards of nurses. So for every nurse we license, we kind of put them on notice that these are the standards that they're going to be held to in the state of Oregon.
So thank you very much.
And we also have a similar booklet, although I didn't give it to you because I know you have enough information, paper information about the Board of Nursing, but we also have one for nursing assistants in Oregon, and we do the same for them. And we also have one for medication aides in Oregon as well, and one for nurse practitioners. So we have a different book for each of them that tells them what the standards are and what the conduct is expected to be.
Okay. We have one for legislators.
We do. We do.
Whoa.
Oh, you mean for... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
She, specifically for Lori Monas Anderson. Legislators that are nurses.
I can tell, you know, Senator Carter is not able to be here today, and so these guys are taking advantage of the peon in the group here.
One of the other questions, and I think it was you, Chair Boone, that asked about if a nurse wanted to come back into practice after she had retired, what would she have to do? And I do want to correct some information. I said she had to go to an 80-hour program, and we have recently changed our rules, and now it's she has to have 120 hours of classroom and 160 hours of clinical experience, which can also be extended another 160 hours if the instructor of that program feels it's necessary.
Okay.
And then I also wanted just to bring your attention to House Bill 2504, which is a bill that is actually going to be before you this session because it does establish a retired senior volunteer program within the Department of Human Services, and I think that's what you were asking about yesterday. So we don't have a program, but there is a bill in this session to allow that, and it would say that any retired nurse could volunteer their services to county governments or health districts if they help to provide the local public health services, and if they volunteer 8 hours a week, the Department of Human Services would provide them health care insurance. And if they volunteer 12 hours a week, then the Department of Health Services would provide health insurance for both them and their spouses.
So if 12 hours was the both?
Pardon?
12 hours was
12 hours was both, yes.
Okay.
And 8 hours would be for health insurance for the retired nurse. So.
And do they have to be licensed then, currently licensed?
You know, the bill isn't clear about that, so that would be one question that we would have as a board. I was not clear about that in the proposed bill.
Okay. Thank you for bringing that up.
And then one other question that came up yesterday, and Madam Chair and Dr. Bates, I think this was from you. You wanted to know what the percentage was of nurses who had associate degrees and baccalaureate degrees. And so this pie graph here indicates that those currently active registered nurses that we have now, the initial degree was bachelor's degrees have 24%, nursing diploma, which is a three-year program. We don't have any of those programs in the state of Oregon, and there are no programs that I'm aware of even on the West Coast. But this used to be how nurses got their nursing education, was to go to a three-year hospital diploma school. So we have some of those nurses still in Oregon, still licensed, 16% of them. had their initial degree by nursing diploma, and then 60% of our currently licensed nurses, their initial degree was in associate degree. Now, these people could have gone on and gotten a higher degree, but this was their initial degree. And then we
just for full disclosure, what we consider our associate degree program, which is a two-year program, in actual fact is probably really almost a three-year program. By the time they get their prerequisites out of the way and then enter the program, most of them have really spent almost 3 years in school. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Dr. Bates, yes, I mean, that is true. Yeah, the associate degree programs, because of all the prerequisites, are inching up to 3 years. And even the baccalaureate programs now are inching up to sometimes more than 4 years.
Okay. Thank you.
Then the one other piece of information we gave you regarding that was the graduates last year of the nursing education programs, what percent were associate degree, what percent were baccalaureate degree. That's this piece of paper, and it shows that 53% of the graduates of Oregon programs last year were associate degree nurses, 45% were baccalaureate degree, and 2% were the new direct entry master's programs that we talked about yesterday. These are the programs where they take someone with a baccalaureate degree or a master's degree in another field that decides they'd like to be in nursing, so they go back to school and go into this expedited direct entry master's program. So. Thank you. So we're ready to start for today, and is your pleasure to start with performance measurements?
Okay. Yeah, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah.
Okay. So the performance measurements are found in the materials that we gave you yesterday, and they're part two. And our performance measurements reflect four agency goals, and those goals are to ensure the safety of those Oregonians that are cared for by nurses, to provide excellent customer service, to regulate in a manner that sustains the maximum number of competent nurses and nursing assistants in the state, and effectively participate in joint efforts to address the nursing shortage. And we use these measurements for budget development, continuing quality improvement, and managing our program towards our performance goals, and a predictor also of emerging issues. We currently have 12 performance measurements for the state, and we have met 10 of those 12 performance measurements, so that's the good news. And the bad news is, of the two that we didn't meet, we really didn't meet them. So we will be talking to you about those and trying to explain the reasons why they were not met. But in general, 10 of the 12 were met. So the very first one is found on page 4 of the document, and this key performance measurement measures timely customer service, and it's the percent of our automatic call distributor telephone calls that are answered by a live person and not abandoned by the caller. This means that we have a customer call center in the office, and our goal is to have a live person pick up the telephone when someone calls the Board of Nursing. And our measure is that we do get that if there are several people calling at one time and they're not picked up immediately, we do pick them up within the amount of time that is acceptable to them, because they're not hanging up and saying, I give up, this is, you know, it's impossible to get hold of the Board of Nursing. So that was our measurement that we had. Our target was 95%, and we did meet that target. Staff vacancies and leave time obviously affect this measure more than any other factor. And significant turnover occurred in mid-fiscal year of 06 in both in the call center and the licensing and certification unit, which did impact some of the performance, but we think we could have gotten higher than 95%. But because it is so staff-dependent, we have our target at 95%. And our current plans are to keep the current staffing levels maintained. So are there any questions on that performance measurement? No? Okay. The second key performance measurement is licensure verification information. And this is the percent of business days in which the licensure verification hotline at the close of each day is current to the previous business day. This is the verification hotlines we have both on the telephone that they can call in or go onto the website that people can call in 24/7 and find out if a nurse is currently licensed and if her license is in good standing. And many employers count on that information. And so we wanted to make sure that 99% of the time that is updated information as of the last business day. And we were able to meet that this year 100% of the time. Key performance three is e-commerce participation, and it's measured by the percent of e-commerce registered nurse renewals compared to total registered nurse renewals. And of course, because it is so much more cost effective for our agency to have people renew their licenses online, we want to encourage that. So our target, because this is e-commerce is fairly new to us, target was 60%, but in actuality last year we made 82% for our actual target. I think one of the reasons that we were able to do this, we talked to other boards of nursing who had started the electronic renewal of licenses, and they said, well, in the first year you're probably going to get about 30% of your licensees doing it. And that was essentially true for us. Last year what we did, we also used to send out the renewal application to the licensee saying you can now renew your license online. Last year we changed that and we sent them out a postcard that said, please go online to renew your license, and if you want a paper copy of the renewal and do it that way, then call us and we'll send it to you. And that made a huge difference because, as I said, now 82% of the licensees do renew online and they seem to really like it. So okay,
Just keep going. Okay. I'll try to keep track of questions.
Okay.
If I don't catch you.
Key performance measurement number four is the timely resolution of complaints. And we're coming to you with the policy package in here because this was one of the ones that we didn't meet. And this is the percent of cases investigated and referred to the board within 120 days of receipt of complaint.
And for the record, my name is Kim Coburn. I'm the program executive for compliance and investigation. And I was thinking, as I was listening to Joan go through the first performance measures, that we were meeting those, and I have to get the pleasure of talking about the one we haven't met. But it's a very important one, and it is one within my area and for which I am accountable and responsible for. And as Joan has mentioned, this is an area in which we are continuing to work on, and in fact our policy measure goes towards this particular performance measure to a large degree. The 120-day requirement is something that is set out by statute for complaints that the board receives. We apply that there has been actually a provision to extend it beyond that. What the 120-day is supposed to measure is the amount of time from the receipt of the complaint, so that's the complaint walking in our door, so to speak, to the time it gets reported to the board for action. There is a mechanism within the statute to permit increments of 30 days to extend that. But we use just the 120-day as a base measure of the timeliness in which we would like to get the complaints to the board. So it's, we could be, quote-unquote, you know, meeting the requirements of the statute simply through giving ourselves extensions. But that's not the performance measure we seek. We seek to do that within the 120 days. If you look at the diagram in your materials or within your performance measures, and you will note page 10 of your materials. What you will see there is a graph of how this measure has gone over the last few years. And you will see, I'm pleased to say, in the last few years we've had a steady increase in meeting that. We had set our goal at 50%, and we still didn't make that at 43%. One of the things I'd like to point out here is the progression, and I may be spending more time on this than you want, but because it gets so tied up into the policy package, I thought I could spend some time really kind of going through what this is doing, if that is okay. One of the things, you know, we first came to the legislature back in 2003 saying, my goodness, we're drowning, we need some help here. And the legislature granted us two positions. We got those in between the 2003-2004. And interestingly, what you see is actually a decrease. We went from 31% down to 21%. And I've spent some time, of course, figuring out why that happened. Essentially, there are two reasons. Most significantly is that we had a 38% change in staff. That is devastating to this type of work in that it is very staff intensive, and there is in fact a fairly good learning curve to get someone up to being able to do cases properly. So that was, you know, kind of issue number one. Issue number two was that we had begun the process of beginning to truly automate and be able to track the workload. It was a real challenge for the agency for a number of years to even understand what the degrees of caseload was that they really had. We knew this information very anecdotally, but we didn't know it very empirically, if you will. And again, the process of learning that. So we're getting more and more refinements on how we understand what our workload is. In 2005, we came back again and said we've made some good progress, but we need to make some more progress, and submitted a package for two new investigators. The staff we had got before, we used one of the positions for a complaint intake coordinator, so that would be one unique point source for all complaints to go to. That individual can then assign them. She can get them into our system. We can begin the tracking mechanism. She can extend an acknowledgement letter back to the complainant saying we have received it, here's what our process is, here's how you may stay informed. So one of the positions was created to do that. The second position, and this is back in 2003, we changed to a straight investigator position to handle the large number of criminal background checks that we have to do. The goal was to as closely meet the resource to the work need that we could. 2005, we came to you and said we needed more. We know enough about our workload now to know that we need more investigators. And the legislature granted us two new investigative positions. Our numbers actually indicated that we needed three. But we did not ask for three because we were still working the process and still hoping we could find improvements through something other than merely kind of throwing bodies at it, if you will. We wanted to understand if there are other ways we could increase our efficiencies rather than merely adding staff. But with the 43% that you see, although it doesn't meet our goal of 50%, what that really represents, though, is those changes we were able to make vis-a-vis the improvements in our process. Because, in fact, although we were granted those positions in 2005, we couldn't get them filled until May of 2006. The nursing shortage affects us all.
and finding someone who has the capabilities that we need for that can be very challenging, even though we have very aggressively sought to fill those positions. So that 43% increase is largely due to the fact that we had been working on the processes rather than the bodies. So we are expecting to see a good improvement, so hopefully hitting our next year's target, because we will have the staff and the processes together for the first time, and I'm actually very much looking forward to that. Any questions?
Go ahead.
Senator Morissette.
Well, not necessarily a question, but the audit that was recently performed recommends two more positions.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, it does. It actually recommends a total of three, but one for a different program, but two for this particular program. One is a lead investigator to help us manage, if you will, all this caseload. It is a tremendous number of cases that we deal with, and to help them be managed better. That is one position. And the other is to provide some more support staff, so that, again, marrying up, if you will, the talents with the needs, to find support staff capable of doing subpoenas and gathering documents at that level rather than at the investigator level. So we will. That is the second position on that.
Chair, I think it is absolutely essential that we look seriously at granting this recommendation, because the alternative is not good. It ends up not only patient safety, but it ends up in court, in the newspapers, all kinds of things. And I think the auditors did an excellent job after a lot of controversy went on, and they found, I think the only solution is to have more investigators. So I just want to emphasize that I think that's extremely important.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I may elaborate on that just a bit. We do have in your materials the executive summaries of those audit reports. There were two that were done. One did involve this particular aspect of the board's work, the investigation process. Essentially, that found that our processes were good, our investigations were good, we were asking the right questions, we were gathering the right information. It just took too long to get it done. So that becomes a workload we need to get. That means it's not really so much a process question. We've got a lot of that already addressed, but it does become more of a, we just need more people to get the work done. And actually, to that note, I should probably add that with this 43% mark that we did meet, that is actually with an 18% increase in the sheer volume of cases that walked through our door. So that actually felt pretty good for us, despite not meeting the mark we had set. I've just been gently reminded to mention that the audit was not an internal audit. It was an external audit that we had outsiders, if you will, come in and talk to our investigators and pull our files and randomly and, you know, check us out top to bottom. One of the largest difficulties we, as some other boards, face is that all the work that we do, or the vast majority of it, is confidential. So we can't say, let's show you this file, Mr. and Mrs. Public out there. We're not able to do that. Nonetheless, there is clearly a sense of responsibility to be accountable to the public. We had thought that doing an external audit would be a means of doing that, to say, you know, here's a, you know, uninterested third party coming in and looking at it and being able to go behind some doors that we're not allowed to open. And please check us out thoroughly, and that's those two reports. Does that make you reminded enough?
Just a comment, having looked at this budget now for 6 or 7 or 8 years, you know, we constrain your budget. It's your money, it's not ours. We constrain your budget,
We watch carefully what you do. We tell you to ramp up more nurses coming into the state. And then we act surprised when you've done the things you were supposed to do and you've had difficulty meeting your goals as far as these kind of issues. Mm-hmm. You've told us for 6 years we don't have enough people to do it. We'll finance it ourselves. And we tell you, no, you can't have the people. I'm not surprised by this, but it's not your problem. It's ours. And we need to fund these positions for you so you can do the job that you've been telling us you need to do and want to do. And all willing to pay for yourself. Is that it in a nutshell?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Can we move on?
Thank you, Senator Dr. Bates.
Dr. Bates has a very nice way of summarizing.
Well, bedside manner.
Oh, great.
I can move on to measure 5 if that's your pleasure, or continue more information here.
Why don't we move on if there are any more questions?
I think we'll be talking about it again when we get to the policy package.
Can we just keep going?
I'm going to continue actually with the next 2 measures, Measure 5 and Measure 6, because those are both associated with my areas of responsibility. The second measure I will speak to is Measure 5, and that is a means of trying to measure the appropriateness of the board's disciplinary actions. The theory behind this performance measure is that if the board acted appropriately and either remediated the situation or punished the situation, it's not going to happen again. We have either through remediation or through very formal discipline, as perhaps suspension or revocation, but we have resolved the problem. We have not merely pushed it along. So we refer to this as our recidivism mark. And the measure that you see is one that we hit. In fact, we surpassed it. Our target was 1%, and we have a zero as our marker here. I have to say, in reality, there was one case that does come out to a 0.14 something percent, but I was told that in statistics here, so we might should have said less than 1% rather than a big fat zero, but I think you get our drift that by this measure it would appear that the board's sanctions and actions are appropriate. Any no questions on that? I'll move to measure 6, which this is one that's always near and dear to my heart. This is a measure that is trying to ascertain how effectively we are resolving cases in terms of not only the measure before, if you will, was how well are we resolving them with respect to public health. Because we're getting the people out of practice, who need to be out of practice, either out or remediated. This measure tries to go to, well, how cost-effective are we in doing that? It is, in some respects, an odd sort of measure. What we look to is the number of cases that we can resolve through a stipulated agreement rather than going through the full contested case process. The contested case process is very expensive. The board doesn't at all skimp on moving forward with the contested case if that's what they believe is necessary and if a resolution is not otherwise possible. But we do try and work cooperatively to come to a good solution, a good resolution that is amenable to the licensee as well as achieving the board's goal of protecting the public. We once had a almost 99% success rate with that, and that has gone down. I don't expect that, down to about 96 percentiles, and I don't expect that, frankly, to ever get back up in the very, very high 90s. Again, the culture surrounding the contested case process and notices given to licensees has changed over the last 5 or 6 years, and it is much more adversarial, if you will, than it used to be. The changes in administrative law have made it more of a it has been moving more towards a normal civil trial model. rather than an administrative hearing model. And the consequence of that is an increase in costs to us, as well as a decrease, if you will, in these stipulated agreements. Some related information that I just kind of, you know, you always come to these things with what I refer to as some back pocket information, just in case you'd like to share it. The number of hearings requested in 2006 is greater than 2005. We currently have 14 hearings that are pending. People have asked for them, we haven't been able to get to them. They are backing up on us. Our AG bills have gone up, I think Pat told me something like, they have gone from a budget of $148,000, and I'm rounding, to a projected cost of $381,000. Mm-hmm. To a large degree, that's because of the hearings costs.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Over what time frame? From
one fiscal year.
1 year.
Mm-hmm.
One fiscal year.
Pat, I'll let you.
Not a biennial.
The numbers that she gave, this is, of course, the problem with back pocket figures.
Madam Chair, Senator Westland, the numbers expressed were our biennial budget. Our current biennial budget is $148,183 for the entire biennium. And a way of thinking of that is it's about a little over $6,000 a month. Currently, our average is running $16,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And we've spent already $283,000 and a little bit. So I'm projecting approximately $381,000 to be spent. So you can see it's well over 100% over budget.
Mm-hmm. That is if you will,
Representative
Nathanson. I'd like to ask a question about this, but if there's more they were going to present on this performance measure, I'm willing to wait another couple of minutes. Should I go ahead and ask?
Go ahead and ask.
I'm thinking about this target of 99%,
yeah.
And on one hand, I really appreciate that you're trying to do what you can to contain costs, to do things efficiently, but yet still effectively, and I do understand that sometimes it really is in the interest of all parties to resolve something without it resulting in a contested case and then turning into something expensive and adversarial. However, I'm a little concerned about having a target for something like this, because does it mean that ultimately there might be a pressure on you at some point when things start getting too expensive to start trying to resolve things maybe that you shouldn't have caved in or tried to resolve too soon? In other words, I don't want you to have to push too hard to just fold the tent and say, well, let's come to an agreement about something. But I'll ask my colleagues if, you know, there may be other better information out there. But I'm a little concerned about the pressure to hurry or resolve something rather than to get it right for everyone's protection.
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, we don't let that drive us, which is why we didn't hit that performance measure, and which is why our AG bill goes up. And in fact, our hearings officers' bills also increase because of that. Because, in fact, we're not willing to have that in the forefront of our heads when we're determining what needs to happen with a particular case. Frankly, what drives that is what's necessary for the public protection. We are a fortunate agency in the sense that we are larger agencies. I know you will probably have smaller agencies coming before you where one or two cases can really break them. That is, you know, presumably we could also at some point hit that point. But it is something to be aware of, but we do not, the board has never let the cost of something stop it from doing what it needs to protect the public.
Thank you. Just a brief follow-up. Thank you. That's good to hear. I liked hearing that response. So then it just leads me to wonder whether that's an appropriate target to keep on the books, 99%. You know, because will it look like you're always not achieving your target, that doesn't seem like a good thing. So I want to think about it from a performance measurement. Should this be more like an activity indicator or something rather than a performance measure? And what does it mean that you're not meeting your target? But that's for another day, probably.
Representative Greg.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay.
In regard to your escalating litigation costs, when you go into a hearing, do you have an in-house attorney or do you hire outside counsel to come in and represent your position on each case?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, we use the services of the Department of Justice. We have an assistant attorney general assigned to us to do our cases for us. So it's not, it's in-house in the sense that the state is the state, and it is not in-house in the sense that it is with a different state agency.
Follow up, did you have to still wind up paying the Department of Justice for the attorney?
Yes.
What is the average cost to you of a hearing that you have to compensate the Department of Justice for?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, that is very obviously quite dependent on the complexity and the length of the hearing. I would estimate somewhere in the neighborhood of $8,000 to $11,000. Knowing full well that we have had cases that have gone into the $40,000 to $45,000, and if you add an appeal, something to the court, contested cases result in a final order, which can then be appealed to the Court of Appeals, that becomes even more expensive.
Can I comment? Representative Nathanson is right. Maybe this should be a performance measurement for the Department of Justice rather than the
I'm glad you said that and not me. Senator Morissette.
Well, I'm going to follow up on both of these comments because I think this is the appropriate time to discuss whether or not they're adequate performance measures. Performance measures are very difficult. We only started this a couple years ago. You go from 100% compliance to 0.5% compliance on another issue, back up to 100% wannabe compliance. I don't know that they should be performance measures, and the reason it's important to talk about it now is that you're going to come up with new performance measures pretty soon that we're going to be talking about, right? As part of this whole budget process. And I remember last year in the Ways and Means Subcommittee of General Government, we kept shaking our heads saying, no, you go back and figure out a different performance measure because what you're telling us is either an activity you're measuring or something that can't be measured. So I think it's really important right now to think about how you're going to come back. Some of these issues you should not be, I don't think, I agree. These are not the right kinds of things to measure if there's no movement. If you're 0.5%, 100%, I mean, no. Give it some more thought, and then when you come back with new performance measures, we'll have an opportunity to judge.
I think we'll go ahead and move on. We've got to get to 12, and we have public testimony, and we have a work session, so proceed.
Key performance measure number the registered nurse examination pass rate, and it's the percent of registered nurse programs with a passing rate of 85% on the national exam. And the board, as you know, we talked about this yesterday, establishes the standards for nursing education. And the national licensing exam for registered nurses provides a mechanism for trying to evaluate the competency and readiness for practice of the nursing program graduates, but also to an extent maybe the effectiveness of the nursing programs in preparing graduates to meet the standards. And it was the board's belief that all nursing programs should achieve the standard of an 85% pass rate of their graduates on the first try, so our target continues to be set at 100%. Last year, 89.5% of the RN educational programs had a pass rate above 85%, and there were 19 registered nurse educational programs in Oregon two of which had pass rates below 85%. And while we still have these two programs not meeting the passage standard, we increased the numbers of programs exceeding the 85% goal. And the two programs that did not meet that goal, we have been working with, and we are seeing increased in improvement for the passing rate this last year. And I want to make sure that you understand that that Oregon overall is consistently the pass rate nationally, and we're always in the top 10 to 15%. And in fact, the national pass rate for the first time test takers for the NCLEX RN for fiscal year 05-06. For a national, it was 87%, and in Oregon, we received 91%, and we were ranked number two nationally in the percent of RN graduates who passed the national exam.
That's great. Can you tell us the two programs that are not meeting the standard?
Yes, it would be Clackamas Community College and Blue Mountain Community College.
Which was the first one?
Clackamas, correct.
Thank you. Any questions?
Key performance measure number 8 is the same thing, only it's for licensed practical nurses. It's the percent of licensed practical nurses programs with a passing rate of 85% on the national exam. Consistently, Oregon has ranked in the top 5% of the number of PN graduates who passed the national exam. And the national pass rate for first-time takers for fiscal year 05-06 was 88%, and Oregon's is 99%. So Oregon is always almost number one in the nation on this. And I think the reason for that is some of the issues that we discussed yesterday. And that was the LPN, the Licensed Practical Nurse Program, has always been the first year of an associate degree program. So the people in the LPN programs were highly qualified in order to get into the ADN programs in the first place. And most of them are going on to get their registered nurse degree. So that's why this is so consistently high.
Okay, I'm swinging right along, but
more if you want. Okay. Then performance measure number 9 is the CNA exam pass rate, and that is certified nursing assistants. So, and the performance measurement is the percent of nursing assistant training programs with a pass rate for first-time test takers above 85% for both the written and the skills portion of the examination. As we mentioned yesterday, the nursing assistant exam is mandated by federal law, and it's also mandated by federal law that there be both a written exam and a skills exam. And so that's an expensive examination to administer. There is no national test for the nursing assistants, so we don't have national data to give you. This was a little bit of a surprise to us to find out what our actuals were for this, because it went down 21%. So we have 68 training programs currently in the state of Oregon for nursing assistants. And we asked our nursing assistant consultant what she was seeing out there in the environment that might make this result what it was. And her analysis of this performance measurement is that there's a decrease in the number of experienced instructors that are teaching these classes. Nursing instructors for nursing assistant programs are extremely hard to find, especially in the rural areas. And there is a lot of turnover in that area as well.
Can I interrupt you here and ask, in your opinion, what this is caused by? In your opinion, or in actuality?
I think there's several factors. I think one is the pay for nursing instructors in the nursing assistant programs. I think also that there's sometimes not a lot of support for them in the nursing homes in regard to the resources for the program, what they're trying to offer.
Thank you.
What are we going to do? I think also on page 21 of this performance report, we talk about other factors that are affecting the results. But I think we asked her also, well, what needs to be done so that we can increase the percentage of this performance measure. She thinks that we should try to talk with the nursing home industry to try to recruit more instructors, and that those instructors need training on effective teaching strategies and adult learning principles. And one of the things that has just happened recently is that we have a new train-the-trainer course in the state of Oregon that is going around to different areas of the state and teaching these instructors a train-the-trainer program. And she thinks that's going to make a lot of difference in the caliber of teaching that's happening there. She's only one person, and she has 68 programs, but according to federal law, she has to do a site visit on those programs once every 2 years. So she's going to try as much as possible to increase the site visits to the program, and certainly for each program, instead of just looking at the classroom portion of the curriculum, she's also going to try to do a site visit and look at the clinical experience, because she thinks that that's where the issues are. These are the skills portion, not the written portion. In fact, they're passing the written portion in the 90%, but it's the skills portion, and they have to pass both of them at once in order to pass the exam.
Okay, Senator Morissette, and then Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lynn Community College has a problem hiring staff because they're limited by the union contract, which is not enough money to pay for instructors. They're signing an agreement with Peace Health Sacred Heart. So the hospital will actually be involved in the hiring of teaching staff, and they can spend time at the hospital and spend time at teaching, and so they will get more money for it. And I think that's one of the ways of getting around it. But it's hard to find instructors who have to take a cut in pay to go teach. So that's part of the problem.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that is one of the problems. And that's not just for the nursing assistant programs, but that's true for registered nurse and LPN programs, too. Faculty salaries are not as high as a nurse can make in the hospitals now, for example. Senator Bates?
Instructors, I'm constantly being asked by nurses who have 30 years, 40 years, flow experience as an RN, and probably know more about nursing than most instructors have forgotten. First thing they get asked is, what's your degree? And many of them have a 2-year degree, and in 30 or 40 years experience at the hospital are told, we can't use you as an instructor. Would you like to comment on that? Is my information correct or incorrect? What are your requirements for an instructor?
The requirements for registered nurse programs are that faculties have to have a master's degree. And for the practical nurse program, the instructors for the theory part have to have master's degree, but their clinical components are allowed to have the baccalaureate degree. And then the preceptors are allowed to have either associate degree or baccalaureate degree.
Madam Chair, follow-up. I would ask you to reconsider your thinking on this a little bit. We have a wealth of nurses out there whose depth and knowledge are actually, I think, being wasted. And a fast-track program to make them instructors would seem appropriate to me if you're really having a shortage of instructors. We've gotten to the mindset if you've got a master's or a bachelor's that you're better than anybody else and can do a better job. I would offer that we've seen some things here make us question that already. But certainly, when we have nurses with that kind of experience, and we, I commonly see someone with a bachelor's degree come onto the floor, and how do they really learn to be a nurse? My son has been there for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And then we turn around and tell that nurse at 30 years, which who says, I'd like to go back and do some teaching and teach what I've learned. And we tell them, well, no, it can't do that. And they kind of go, okay. Please consider that. Other programs have that. If you have a vast experience, they give you a 6-month or 1-year course, and you go back in and become an instructor, I think it's something you might want to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And Co-Chair and Dr. Bates, the administrative rules for nursing programs are up for review this year, so we're going to have, and we always have in the past as well, had a wide representation on our task forces, and so I'm sure that this issue will come up.
Thank
we
you.
Will look at that. I also want to say that the hospitals are really stepping up in terms of trying to provide faculty for the nursing education programs. There are a lot of hospitals in conjunction with the community colleges now that are paying for a nurse faculty member, or in the case of Providence here in Portland, they put almost $13 million into a contract between the University of Portland and Providence, and one of the things that they're doing is they're putting a whole unit on the hospital floor that is only for student teaching, and they're using their hospital nurses as the preceptors for the students in that hospital. So
that's good.
Because there are all kinds of different models that are being used because of the acute nursing faculty, and that's one of them.
To hear. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want the panel to know that I support and endorse the statements just made by Senator Bates.
Mm-hmm. And I do too. And I would further suggest maybe even, you know, in your returning nurses programs, as far as even allowing part-time instructors in that sense. So sometimes people don't want to work full-time, but they have a lot to add, and they have a lot of experience they can share, and very, very valuable experience. And I hope that we all, as we, I mean, most of us are pretty young still, but that we will be seen as some sort of value to our future predecessors, I guess, coming up after us in some way or another. And Dr. Bates will, for sure, he'll be volunteering for the rest of his days, I'm sure.
Put him on the task force.
Yeah, by a crack, you get me out there and
I'd just like to add, I would much rather have any of your nurses give me a shot than Dr. Bates.
All right, moving right along.
Goal 10 is that increase in the registered population in Oregon, and that's the performance measure is a number of basic registered nurse students who have graduated from the Oregon Nursing Education Programs and are practicing in Oregon. So not only did they graduate from an Oregon program, but they're staying here and working, and that's what this is trying to measure. And you can see that some of the efforts of the nursing shortage has really started to pay off in regards to the number of nurses that were graduating in the state. We had 740, and in 05 we had 999. And the reason that it reflects here a decrease in fiscal year 06, it really did not happen. The problem is that the performance measurements are done on the fiscal year, and a lot of the nursing education programs don't graduate their graduates until June, and then they have to take the national exam. So they haven't, their exam scores are not. They didn't get licensed until after June 30th. That's what I'm saying. So I do have the number that as of June, as of December 31st, we had 1,059 RN graduates last year in Oregon programs. So we are increasing.
I'm sorry. I need to ask you. How does your I know you're working with businesses and other people, but are you taking credit for something that your board hasn't really been doing?
Sandra Moore said, "That's a very interesting question, because we ask ourselves that we hope that it reflects the work that our education consultant does, but we raised that, and this question was raised last year in the Ways and Means Committee, and we were thinking about taking all of these performance measurements away that are talking about the RN pass rates and the number of graduates, etc. And the discussion at that time was that that may be true, but this is the only way that the legislature sees this kind of data, and
therefore we'd like to keep these performance measurements in the Board of Nursing.
Okay, so. It's not a performance measure. It's interesting data to have, but you couldn't get that across another way, because a performance measure is an achievable goal that is based on action that you take, I think. And it's a quantitative and qualitative goal. With qualitative is hard to measure, but I mean, I think it's important information, but I don't know why it's a performance measure, is what I'm saying.
Senator Morissette will be heading up the task force on philosophical other stuff. Representative Grard.
Thank you. I don't know whether this has anything to do with anything other than my own curiosity. What percentage of your graduates are males?
It used to be, Co-Chair and Senator Grard, Representative Grard, it used to be 2%, but now it's up to 10% of the practicing nurses in the state of Oregon are males, and actually statistics I saw just a couple of weeks ago said that 25% of students in nursing education programs this year are males.
Thank you.
Dr. Bates.
Just a couple of questions real quickly. First off, I guess I do have to kind of agree with my colleague to the right. You're not running the programs, but you do influence the programs, and you're part of the push to make those programs be more, to produce more nurses. And you are the programs that almost doubled the number of nurses graduating every year over a period of 7 or 8 years, which is pretty impressive. So the programs are working hard.
Right.
And you're involved in licensing and make sure the quality stays up in those programs. So I do think you get some credit for it. But admittedly, not all of it, and it's not a true performance measure. Having said all that, because this is the key piece of information bringing to us today, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not real concerned about the quality of nursing in this state. I think it's excellent. I think you'll keep it there if we give you the right resources. I think you'll take care of the outlying fraction of 1% that has trouble. I think you'll stay on top of that. Oh, it makes the newspapers, primarily because it's such an exceptional thing. That's why it makes the newspapers. It means you're doing your job. I'm more concerned with what the 1,000 to 1,200 nurses will be graduating from Oregon schools mean as far as workforce is concerned. How many are we losing each year? I think it's like I'm looking like a snake. It's got two lumps going through it. One's this lump of nurses in their 40s and early 50s. The other lump is the one we're bringing in here, and they're kind of like going along. And I don't know if we're still graduating. Let's say we get up to 1,200. Is that the right number for what we think our future needs are and for what we need as far as right now and the future? I know that most of the nurses you graduate stay in the state. That is not true of physicians. The last time we looked, less than 50% stay in the state from the University of Oregon Medical School, which is another problem I have to deal with. But most of your students seem to stay in the state, which is great. Second question is, what do we really need? What do you think the workforce requirement really is on an annual basis?
Senator Bates, we're still not graduating enough nurses, because I think as we showed yesterday, 50% of nurses in the state are over the age of 50, and 13% are over the age of 60. So we're going to see a mass exodus when the baby boomer nurses are ready to retire. I feel that I can give a lot of information about the supply side of nurses, but on the demand side, I really don't know that information as well as probably the Department of Employment would know that. We don't interview the employers out there to see what do they anticipate the demand for nurses is going to be. I can just tell you that every article that's written about the nursing shortage and everyone that talks about the nursing shortage says that by the year 2012 and certainly by the year 2020, there's going to be a massive, severe shortage of nurses because of the retirement.
Madam Chair, follow up. You have a lot to do. Not enough people do it. But I'd like to know, I think that should be one of your concerns. Board of Medical Examiners, soon to be the Board of Medical, whatever, is concerned about that and does try to track that. And I think it's worthwhile, that's something you should be considering and thinking about and bringing to us. and saying, we've got a shortage, this is the number it should be. It should be 1,500, it should be 2,000. Give us an idea of what it should really be. I don't know of any other way we'll get it. ESCO education has to come here. It has to be a constant drumbeat on what the real need is.
I've had conversations with the governor's economic development people because I am a proponent of rural health, and what I keep saying is this is an economic development issue. It's a double economic development issue because talk about family wage jobs, and I think that, okay, what can you do? Maybe partnering with the governor's office to have some concrete steps to create these healthcare jobs in Oregon, and be site specific. What do we need to create and keep people in rural health areas? And let the governor come in and say, hey, this is an economic development issue. We're willing to put lottery money in. We're willing to put money into job creation that happen to be healthcare jobs. And that's a good partnership. And I'm surprised because I talked with the governor's office, economic development director, and then the governor sent him back over to talk again. So there is an interest in that. These are family wage jobs, and they're necessary in terms of healthcare.
Madam Chair and Dr. Bates, I would like to clarify that I didn't mean that the Board of Nursing didn't care about the supply side. We care a lot, and we are working in partnership with like the Oregon Center for Nursing, and they're trying to gather that data as well. You know, we and even a lot of the at 3 o'clock today, there's testimony from nurses about and there's educators and the employers of nurses and all aspects of nursing are going to get together to talk about what is it that's going to be needed in the years ahead. So we're working in partnership with everybody else, and we really do care about it. I just don't have those numbers for you.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Burley, I apologize. I slid right by you. You're so quiet today.
That's quite all right.
Please go ahead and ask. Listening intently to the conversation, and Senator Bates' comments as well as Senator Morissette's comments remind me of the headline that most of us read in the Oregonian today that tells us that 1 in 6 Oregon students, I think it's K-12 students, are Latino. That's currently. And so I wonder, that says something about the demographics now, but it also says volumes about our future workforce. And so what are we doing strategically, aggressively, to target that population with information about the profession, this profession as an option? What do those efforts look like?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I agree with you that the population of Oregon is going to look very different in the coming years, and I anticipate that the nursing profession, demographics of the nursing profession, will look much differently as well. In the handouts that we gave you yesterday, and in part one of supplemental materials, there's a report about what the nursing community is doing to try to increase diversity in the workforce. And briefly, the nursing community has held a summit. They held a summit in 2005 to talk about workforce diversity. And as a result of that, there's representation from there's like 4 different work groups, and they represent over 19 regional nursing schools and healthcare organizations, and they organized themselves into 4 groups, and the 4 groups are going to be the Nursing Workforce Diversity Steering Committee, and it has Hispanic and Latino representation on it. They have another subgroup that's talking and looking at the nursing admissions database work group so that we can start tracking this information on diversity and the nursing programs and better.
And they're trying to get one centralized place where all the applications to nursing programs can go, so we can get a feel for truly how many students are applying for nursing school, because right now it's so hard to get into the nursing schools that one nurse may be applying to four different schools, and perhaps that she's counted four times. So one of the things this database is going to try to do is to get a sense of unduplicate that list, and also to get a sense of how many of the minority people are applying to nursing education programs. The third group is the recruitment and retention work group, because not only do we want to retain people into, or recruit people into the nursing program, but we want to retain them as well. And I know one of the things they're looking at is they say that new nurses often leave between 24 and 36 months after they've become a nurse. So that's kind of a dangerous period. And so they're looking at how do we retain those new nurses as well, and how can we support them, and how can we, as these nurses get older, also change the workplace and the environment in the workplace so that we can make it easier for nurses to stay in the nursing profession longer. And then finally, they're looking at curriculum and staff development work groups, and again, they're looking at that in terms of the workforce diversity issue. So there are initiatives that are happening out there in the state around this issue. And I think you can tell from the statistics that are that we also gave you in supplement number one, that we have made progress in increasing the ethnic diversity in nursing profession. We certainly haven't done a good enough job, but we are starting to make some progress here. And the Oregon for Center for Nursing is very much going out there and trying to target the high schools, for example, and talking to them about the need for nurses. And they're not sending somebody like me out there. They're sending a minority nurses who can go out there and relate to them and tell them what a great profession nursing is, and encouraging them to go in and say, you know, I've done it and it's a great job, and you should think about nursing.
If I may follow up, Madam Chair, I would suggest, I do suggest, recommend that we need performance measures, a measure or measures focused on the initiatives that you just described and defined, so that we are tracking our progress, and we're tracking our progress in an aggressive manner. The future workforce in nursing, the future workforce within the population, the Latino population, is a workforce that we need to be looking at in a number of sectors. That is our future. And I'm concerned that if we don't identify performance measures, we won't focus in a laser-like manner on moving ourselves forward, and in fact moving the state forward. The population is here now, and the population is going to grow. That's the reality. And I also come at this from a realization that in 1978-79, when I was wearing another hat, community-based organizing and working with a whole host of organizations in the community focused on education, we saw this coming. We saw this demographic shift coming. And so we've known about it, but we haven't planned for it. We haven't planned for it in education. We haven't planned for it in terms of workforce. And so we're racing to catch up, not only as a state, but as a nation. And we need to be much more aggressive in our efforts. We need to come at this smarter and much more collaboratively. And that's what I'm looking for. That's what we should all be looking for. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm gonna do something a little unusual here. I'm not sure how much longer you have, but I'm going to call up our public testimony at this point and make sure that we get that in. Alicia, is it Juber? And then when she finishes, you can finish up.
Mm-hmm.
This one. Welcome, Alicia, and when you get settled, if you'll just please give us your name for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Chair. My name is Alicia Juber.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Before I start, I wanted to definitely address the fact that I think that Joan Bouchard and Kim Cobain have done a tremendous job with this presentation. It has informed me about many things I didn't know, and I think that they have worked very hard to come to this point to address the Senate committee. So I'm going to try to go pretty fast. No, I'm now interrupting their presentation.
No, you're very welcome, and I wanted to make sure that you had enough time to give your presentation today.
Thank you. I am a bit nervous, and that's just part of me. So I started. Please forgive me if I'm not as articulate as others present might be on a very difficult subject. I know I will be a bit redundant, but this is an issue of extreme importance to me. Yesterday, as I listened to the beginning of the presentation made by Joan Bouchard of the Board of Nursing, I knew I had to go home and write just a bit more to the testimony I was going to give you yesterday, today. Please forgive me, I'm not good at writing. It's a big problem with me. As I listened, I heard Ms. Bouchard stress over and over all the issues, and I mean rightly so, all the issues facing the board now and in the future with the number of nurses now in membership, training classes, 2 years versus 4 years of college issues, assuring the need to increase the number of nurses in our state, and all the needs for funds to do this. I won't repeat all of them, as I know you heard them loud and clear. Even though two of the esteemed committee members voiced approval of funds at the beginning of the presentation, I'm not quite sure I was going with that, I too could see in the beginning of the presentation additional funds will be needed to fulfill the board's responsibility to see public safety as a first priority, and how difficult it will be with the day-to-day needs of a large membership. What I want to say before reading my initial testimony is that I am fervently validated in the opinion the nurse monitoring program needs to be handled by a source other than the Board of Nursing. All I heard yesterday was the amount of time necessary to address the needs of licensed nurses in this state. That was the 99% of 6,000 or 67,000 total nurses, with the final 1% of 670 who need extra special care, like those in the nurse monitoring program, or just ones who need to be monitored more closely, though not in the program. Possibly even some of the discipline issues need to be looked into as difficult. I did hear Senator Morris said, you stated you would like to see all state agencies follow the model of the board, but I wasn't sure what model that was. Was it for teaching, investigation of complaints? I just wasn't clear, and it would help me in my understanding of what the board's asking for. I'll go on with what I was actually going to say yesterday.
If it's easier for you, because you have a long letter, we all have it, and if you would like, if it's easier for you to summarize it, and you can,
I'd really like to read it, please.
All right.
If that's all right. I'll try to read fast enough.
Oh, okay. I just want to help make it more easy for you.
Thank you. I first appeared before a joint committee for Health and Human Services in 2004, asking for assistance in righting an injustice I believe left vulnerable citizens of our state in danger. The Board of Nursing had an integral part in that plea for help. The injustice I refer to was my father's death, January 18th, 1997. 1998 at Sheridan Care, a nursing home. His untimely death was due to a lethal dose of overdose of morphine by a board-licensed nurse. Now, 3 years... In 2006, I also approached a Senate committee, and Now, 3 years later, I continue my plea with the honorable members of the Ways and Means Committee on Human Services because of recommendations made in the joint report of the Board of Nursing and Department of Justice, offered by Pete Shepard of the DOJ and Joan Bouchard of the Board of Nursing. Their combined reports at the Senate Interim Health Committee hearing, October 10, 2006, suggested the need for substantial funds to meet those recommendations. Governor Kulongoski, who I believe appoints the board, offered a letter also advocating for complete approval of funds at the hearing. I would join the chorus but have serious concerns. I believe in the necessity of an improved budget to assure the Board of Nursing will put public safety as their top priority while they care for the needs of the nurse membership. The ever-increasing problems facing health care in this state, including lack of nurses, dictates those needs. My reservations come from concerns which have haunted me for 8 years, and I pray committee members will diligently review all information available before approving funds to an agency that hasn't, in my opinion, always lived up to its own philosophy of public safety as a primary obligation. My reasons for stating so strongly an opinion are as follows. The members of the Board of Nursing have always had an obligation to strictly adhere to policies in place and to make sure that staff keep up-to-date reports on their membership. By their own statistics, only a small portion of that otherwise large and wonderful membership. I've had 18 surgeries. That means I've been in the hospital, and I've always been well cared by nurses. And they're wonderful. It has problems that require extra monitoring or enrollment in the nurse monitoring program. In 1997, they failed in that obligation, and since I have had little trust in the board, then having allowed a nurse with an encumbered license because of dangerous behavior to work in a nursing home. There was alleged to have lethally overdosed four of the residents in a short 3 months of employment. A fifth, he unbelievably was allowed to put in hospice, was dying. By a miracle, she was saved, and he was no longer put on schedule, not fired, and not reported. How, starting as early as the late 1980s till 1997, could the board not believe this nurse needed special monitoring? If the board had lacked funds for extra staff, why did they take the risk? The board did not appear overburdened in 1998 when a serious criminal allegations were brought against the encumbered nurse by a peer. An investigator immediately interviewed the reporting nurse. I was interviewed 3 hours the next day with assurances this was serious and immediate action would take place. What's transpired after has for 8 years disgusted and emotionally and physically exhausted me as I tried to seek justice. Why does it take civil litigation to get some semblance of justice? In March 2006, after others' concerns about the Board of Nursing were made public in the Portland Tribune, and the public has a right to know what is going on in a state agency if there are concerns about what that agency is doing, the Board of Nursing and the DOJ then took action at the request of the Senate Committee of Human Services. I was encouraged to testify at a public board meeting where the Board of Nursing attorney told me that two laws passed as a result of this case. One was in late 99 when the Salem Office of Senior and Disabled Services took over the investigation from the understaffed local McMinnville office. It pertains to sharing the confidential files between state agencies. I couldn't find it. My computer broke down. And the second in 2001, and the bill number is 201C2756, which pertains to reinvestigating a licensee even after their license has lapsed. Yes, these two laws are positive results, but where is the accountability for the travesty 10 years earlier, as it wasn't retroactive? I also attended one of the task force meetings, which left me with concerns, as there are board members who dominate it, pushing their own agenda. On a couple of occasions, I spoke with Pete Shepard of the DOJ and Joan Bouchard and Kim Cobain, who were there in 1997, asking questions. Why did the board nursing let this encumbered nurse work at a nursing home in 97 with no senior regard for public safety and not monitoring, even though not in the nurse monitoring program? He was not in the program, but he was on an encumbered license. The care center's administrator and staff had some responsibility for watching him, but I believe the board did not relay all the history about this nurse. Should information so important to public safety be kept confidential? Liking funds is no excuse. Would they still do that now? Why did the nurses at Sheridan Care feel they could not report incidences of abuse of drugs directly to the board after being threatened by their supervisors with losing their jobs? They knew reporting abuse was the law. 4 people lost their lives prematurely as a result. Only one went to the board 8 months later after confessing to me at Papa Murphy's, August of 98. She subsequently stated she felt not taken seriously by the board of nursing. Why did the initial investigator in a 3-hour interview tell me there would be immediate action due to the egregious nature of the allegation, only to later be told, don't call back? Why did the Board of Nursing give an appearance of, I'm sorry, I have to use the sperm phrase, covering up what happened by letting the license of the nurse in question lapse, doing nothing further? This was 4 months after the initial allegation, and they did not at any time inform law enforcement. Lacking funds is no excuse. In 120 days, more harm could be done. He could have run. Why was this case not extended? Was that not part of policy in 1997? Do they realize the nurse in question could go to another state and apply for a license because the Board of License did not take his license away or suspend it? Something similar happened in Texas. This is, I'm going just from memory here. The nurse was from Oregon, the result being murder. Did the board feel there was any wrongdoing in 1998? Were there any other questions? There were many other questions, and to most I felt I was not getting, I said to most, not all. I did get answers to some, but I did not feel I got complete or acceptable answers to others. I was asked to write a paragraph encouraging nurses to report incidences because of my experiences. Kim Cobain was going to share them at training seminars. I declined. That request was on the tail of the October 10th interim committee, or just before, and I was frustrated by some of the presentation. I'm sorry now for missing an opportunity to help assure hesitant nurses about reporting. Today I ask honorable members of the committee to please consider more money is not always the only answer. Sometimes it's as simple as demanding our state agencies follow the law and their own existing policies. They need to be willing to publicly admit mistakes and then improve by reprimanding and maybe even removing staff not doing their jobs. Appointed board members are no exception. It should not have taken 10 years for a task force or audit to tell them what was very plain in 1997. They weren't monitoring the 1% of their membership closely enough. And maybe the nurse monitoring program is beyond their capabilities with such a large membership, demanding time. If they now have a membership of 67,000, and of that wonderful group of nurses, only 1% create headaches of logistics and need, maybe the nurse monitoring program needs to be handled by an outside agency more highly trained for this sort of work. They, meaning the Board of Nursing, would then be freed up to devote their valuable time to the rest of this growing, or maybe shrinking because of retirement membership. This recommendation was made at the first task Oh, was made at the first task force meeting, the recommendation being the nurse monitoring program be moved to an outside source. By Pete Shepard of the Department of Justice, Meredith Cody of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and Dolores Huber of the, well, it's the Board of Nursing Home Administrators. There needed to be time allotted to that discussion, as it was pivotal in the need for funds and the time it takes from the board to administer. At that meeting, the other one, which I attended, certain board members would stop all discussion on this issue. That was when I knew something, that nothing had changed. Mrs. Cody had her concerns quoted in the final report of the task force dated October 24th. I don't know if that's in your work. I didn't have enough money to make more copies of things at this time. Though Mrs. Huber's name is not mentioned, the last paragraph of that report states it was footnoted number 7 in that report, Ms. Cody's comments. I'm sorry. Though Mrs. Huber's name was not mentioned, the last paragraph of that report states 2 task force members concerned. Mrs. Huber's the second. I was told, and I'm sorry, this maybe isn't appropriate, but I was told that both walked out of subsequent task force meetings due to the lack of open discussion promised at the first meeting. Transparency is needed in state agencies. I ask each member of this committee, while you decide the budget for the Board of Nursing, you might also look individually into introducing law that covers egregious allegations like the one in August of 1998. There needs to be immediate mandatory reporting to the Department of Justice for serious abuse to senior citizens by any agency entrusted with the public safety. Also, though it may not be relevant here, mandatory autopsies for any death occurring in a nursing home. Had this been law in our state in November 1977, things might have turned out differently, and the reason we are here today would have happened much sooner than 10 years later. It is law in other states. I shudder at the thought of what could be happening to other citizens with no one knowing. This has been very difficult for me today to speak so bluntly. I know there are people who would like to have the Sheridan Care case forgotten, as just a terrible embarrassment. To me, it was a heinous crime still not answered for. Thank you for listening and your possible consideration of the things I offer here today. And in closing, I would just like to say, Governor Kulongoski, in his before the election in his campaign ads, made a statement that keeps me hanging on to this case after 10 years and going to different senators starting in 2004 asking for help, which might have started this whole process 3 years earlier. Going to the Department of Justice 2 years before that, asking for help in this case. It might have started it 6 years earlier. But in his campaign speeches, he said he honors individual citizens of this state who stick to it when they have something they need to say. I don't know the exact quote. I'm sort of paraphrasing what he said. But he gave me courage. When you voted for him, he gave me courage to stay and keep trying to do this, as difficult as it is. But I appreciate your time, and I'm sorry that it took so long. Thank you so much. If you have any questions.
Alicia, thank you so much. It's very courageous of you to come and face us and with people in the room that you're talking about. And I know this
care about them for very, the work they do. I'm sorry.
Very difficult, yeah. And I know.
Madam Chair, may I?
And I'm sorry for your loss.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Morrison.
I've been involved, not intimately, but have been involved and have met with Ms. Huber a number of times. The Attorney General's office was deeply involved in this case, and I do have a bill that inserts public safety into the mission statement. That is part of the reconciliation, so to speak. There was one recommendation that the AG's office take over all of the investigative duties, and that's something that might be considered at some point. Shouldn't it be removed from the Board of Nursing? Should it be an independent body? It's a matter of, well, it's a fiscal thing in some ways, but it's something that is a legitimate concern. And the AG's office has been, you know, Pete Shepard has been mediating some of this stuff, and we have been working our way through it. I do think that improvements are made, and there needs to be continued oversight, and we may come back and visit this again in my committee, because we've had these hearings during the interim. So I do deeply appreciate your ongoing concern about this, because it does take courage, and you are having an impact. You are making a difference.
Thank you very much, Senator Morrison.
And you're absolutely right. All health professionals are required by law to report abuse, all abuse. Senator Bloomley.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your courage and for coming forward. And I do want to ask a question about your testimony. Is one of your requests, you talk about mandatory autopsies for any death occurring in a nursing home, and point out that other states have this kind of law. Are you asking that this legislation be drafted?
Yes.
To cover this purpose?
Yes, okay. Because that would have maybe stopped a few things.
All right.
I know this is not the appropriate committee for that, but that was for us.
Well, your request and your testimony is very appropriate, very appropriate. I just wanted to be certain about what it is you were asking.
Yes.
Happy to work with you on that.
Thank you so much, Senator Gordon.
Anybody else have any questions? Oh, Dr. Bates.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, this must be terribly painful for you to have to do this, go through this process, and I have some no sympathy for you. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions, because I'm not, frankly, real familiar with this part of the state where this wasn't highlighted, and I was kind of surprised by some of it. Just for my own knowledge, was there ever a criminal charge brought, a grand jury convened, and did the board ever take action on this from your point of view?
No, the board did not take any action. That was the problem. I was told never to call again, and when they did not take action, I then called because I didn't know what to do. So I called the local office, because I had called Governor, I think it was Kitzhaber's office then, and I called and asked, what do I do? And they said, call your local senior and disabled services and have them do an investigation. Well, that investigation took 6 months, and they were understaffed. And when nothing was happening after 6 months, because I was worried about memory, time this man could run, all those questions, I was then told to take it to the Salem Office of Senior and Disabled Service. And in June of 1999, almost a year later, that investigator with the sheriff's office started an investigation. They immediately, subpoenaed files, which they were not given prior to. They were not given files. Then the Department of Justice became involved because a local district attorney felt the case was too big for him. And I was told it would go to grand jury by October of 1999, and it didn't go to grand jury until, I believe it was August of 2000, and that's because the DOJ did another, well, they basically just added to the other investigation. And there was a grand jury. I have my own belief as to why they did not indict, and it's my opinion, but they did not indict. I was told by the district attorney and by the Department of Justice, if you have more evidence, we will reconvene. I took them both more evidence, and that's part of the pain that has been involved and my beginning to totally lack belief in the justice system. Pete Shepherd assured me that after this investigation that was started in 2006, because a newspaper wrote articles about the Board of Nursing that some things I didn't even know about, Pete Shepherd said, let me get through just trying to help the Board of Nursing improve what they're doing, and at the end of that, I will then look at the evidence that you have tried to present. I have not had the opportunity yet, but I've called him a couple of times to do that. I mean, when a nurse stands over a man who the second day that this nurse has been giving him morphine, and two nurses or CNAs, at least nurses, hear him say to my father, this is prior to my getting to the nursing home, if they had given you the medicine they should have last night, you'd be dead by now. If that is not some sort of premeditated thing that needs to be looked at immediately, I don't know what is. And that is part of the testimony of the nurse who initially presented it to the Board of Nursing. So I'm sorry, but... I'm sorry. Thank you for asking the question. I hope I answered.
You did. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you for all your time.
Thank you, Alicia. Any more comments?
Well, Kevin Neely was the attorney general who worked on this case, and her description of the case is, as I heard it, the grand jury was convened. There wasn't evidence presented. The part that I did not hear, and I'm going to follow up because I will call Pete Shepherd, we dealt with this in my committee during the interim, I mean this whole Board of Nursing thing, and I will ask Pete Shepherd specifically if he did make that statement, and if he didn't, then I'll talk to him again, and I'll... I empathize, and if there is evidence and it should be pursued, then it should be pursued, but the AG... worked with the local district attorney, did get the grand jury. They normally don't do that, except in extraordinary circumstances, and the grand jury did not do anything. Now, if there is new evidence that should be presented, I will certainly help move that along, and I will call Pete Shepherd.
Could I please have a follow-up to what...
Yes, you may.
Madam Chair,
thank you.
Senator Morissette, I... presented my information to Kevin Neely of the Attorney General's office in 2001, and for 4 months he stalled me. He literally lied to me that it was being looked at, because 2 months later I called and spoke with the attorney, the assistant attorney, you know, general attorney, who told me he had just gotten the case on his desk that morning, and he was told not to look at it until Brenda Rockland looked at it because she was his boss. When I called back a couple of weeks later to find out what's happening, he no longer had the case. He'd been taken off of it. Now, I'm sorry to make such an allegation against Kevin Neely. I understand he's normally a pretty substantial fellow. All I know is what personally I experienced in talking with him, and ultimately what I experienced from another Department of Justice attorney when I went to pick up the evidence, because he said, we're doing nothing about this case. And when I just shared the one quote that I was given in that case, plus a couple of others, he said, oh, I didn't know that was there. I didn't see that. And then stood up and said, you need to leave my office. We're doing nothing about this. So I've had my problem with the Department of Justice, and I don't think it's all because I'm a nut. So I'm sorry. I had to follow that up because that's part of it.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Morissette, for taking this on. And boy, this is, it's tough to do, but I have to do it. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 5528. An open public hearing on Senate Bill 5052. And this is, if you'll turn to your policy option purchases, this is the fee bill. And Alicia, thank you again for coming forward. I know that was difficult. Go ahead. We have a very, very short time. We have a committee starting in here at 3, and we're going to get bumped. So I'm sorry, but you'll have to really be quick.
Madam Chair, I will make this very quick. I am Pat Miles. I'm the business manager for the Board of Nursing. The bill before you, House Bill 5052, is ratifications of fees that we changed administratively during this biennium. They are four fees. Two of them are established. Two of them are decreased. They are
They are all three pertaining to clinical nurse specialists. These are advanced practice nurses. And in the 2005 legislative session, you passed Senate Bill 460, allowing them to prescribe medications. We enacted those rules this fall, and these fees address that. We created an initial... the first fee is the initial clinical nurse specialist certification. It was at $200 when we established the licensing type. We are reducing it to be in sync, if you will, with nurse practitioner initial certifications. The renewal we've reduced as well. It was at $100. We're reducing it to $75. And that's because when we renew a certification with prescribing authorities, we wanted that to be equal to that of a nurse practitioner at $105. And finally, we had to establish an initial application for gaining prescribing authority, and we established that also at the same rate as a nurse practitioner at $75. Do I have any questions?
Wow.
That was fast. Any questions?
Okay, well, thank you, and with that, I'll close the... Oh, excuse me, we have public testimony on this. Is there anybody signed up? Okay, if there's no further action, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5052. And thank you for coming. And I know. What do we do now? You didn't quite finish your... how much more time do you suppose you have?
We don't have to take a lot of time. We were just going to talk about the policy package and why we needed the new position.
Okay, right, okay. I'm sorry. A little rattled here. Okay, please go on. I'll reopen the Senate Bill 5528 policy package.
In the interests of time, I'm going to jump straight to what it is we're asking for, which are three positions. These are the result of the external audits that we have spoken to previously in our testimony. The three positions that are requested are: one is a lead investigator that would work the full investigation caseload. You have in your materials, and we have some slides, if I let Pat get there, demonstrating the amount of work, the caseload that we have on an annual basis. I also took a snapshot picture, if you will, of what we had open on our plate on the 30th. The total, we had 922 investigations open. We had 485 background investigations open. We had 283 people in the nurse monitoring program, and we had 67 people on probation. That, if you add up, is over 1,700 people we are keeping track of on a one cases we are keeping track of. We need someone who is going to focus just on managing and keeping that manageable. So that is the one position, lead investigator, to manage the day-to-day caseload. The second position requested is for an increase of an AS2 position. That individual would be assigned to collecting documents, gathering information, dealing with subpoenas, court records, etc., to assist with the investigative process, but if you will, at a lower pay scale than what we are having our investigative staff do. The third position is another coordinator for our nurse monitoring program. We currently have two. They carry a caseload between the two of them of about 300 cases. That's a lot. You could do the simple math on that given the number of participants, and they have approximately 1 hour per month to deal with each person on that list. That is far too little. There is more expansive information about this within the audit materials, which you have as part of your materials if you'd like to see them. But those are the three positions. And do you want to know what expectations we have out of them, or shall I leave you to your deliberations?
You can do it in 25 words or less.
Yes. There's another meeting that comes in here at 3, and it requires a change in the seating arrangements and new materials being put out.
Can you do it really quickly?
As to what the expectations we have out of this?
Madam Chair, I have a...
Senator Gordon.
Just to follow up on Representative Morgan's comment, I would suggest that we stop, and when we come back together again, we start from where we are now.
Okay, why don't we do that?
We have more time on the budget, so.
Because you're coming back anyway. I was actually asked to share this at the last minute, so I didn't have all the game plan out. But okay, so we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill.
Excuse me, Chairwoman, I'm sorry. Can I just quickly say one thing in regard to the case that Ms. Juber was talking about? I just wanted
very briefly
that the board did want to take action against that licensee, and they voted to take action against the licensee, but his license had expired by the time we were able to do that. So the board came back, and we were told we could not then take any action on the licensee. And the board then came back the next legislative session to get a bill passed so that we are now allowed to do that. So we did take proactive action.
Thank you.
And the report of the Department of Justice is in your report, and it's on Supplemental 1, and as well as the executive summaries of the audit report, because we did want to share all that information with you. So.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, and with that, I'll close the Senate Bill 5528. And with any more business before the committee? The committee is closed.
Adjourned.